Accession number 9424, Reel 2.
Mr. Cooper, Reel 2. How long were you at Pries Heath?
I was there from April 1917 until the autumn of 1917. I can't remember just which month.
And then you moved to
to Oswestry, yes.
Was Oswestry any different to Pries Heath in any particular way? Can you remember?
Well, I liked it better because it was all among pine trees, and there were more entertainment there, and there was a theatre and bigger canteens. Otherwise, the training was much the huts were much the same, and the ablutions, as they call them, they were just about the same as Pries.
Perhaps you could describe the social side of the camp then, seeing that was something obviously appealed to you.
Well, there was a church army had very nice huts there, and the Salvation Army and the YMCA, all where you could get hot tea and sandwiches and buns cheaply, and there was a piano there where they used to get round and play. And then also in the Park Hall camp there was what they call the Garrison Theatre. It was a large wooden building, and they had all different plays, some of them from the provinces in London, every week. And as the plays didn't end till after 10 at night, well, the fact that when you bought a ticket, you had to pay for it, probably about sixpence or a shilling. When you bought a ticket for a play, that ticket was automatically a late pass to get into the hut late.
Did you actually go into Oswestry itself?
Yes, I think it took about 20 minutes or half an hour, I can't really remember. And quite a nice town, and we used to go to they had a theatre there we often used to go to. There must have been cinemas too, but I can't just remember, but there were cafes, etc., which we could go to. We always used to look forward to going into Oswestry. I used to go with my pal, Bill Pottles, who later went out to France with me.
Could you remember what the relationship was between the townspeople and the soldiers in the camp?
Well, perfectly good, but I don't think any of them were invited. They may have been, but none of our chaps ever said they were invited to the houses to tea or anything. But they just took us for granted, I think. Same as now when I go into Croydon, all the people shopping there don't take much notice of me. Well, it was about the same there, I think.
Did you use the local pubs at that time, or the soldiers?
Well, as the soldiers would do, yes.
Did you yourself?
No, because I didn't drink. I've no interest in drinking.
Okay. To return to the camp life for a moment, was there any aspect of training at Oswestry that was different from the training that you had undergone at Pries Heath?
Much the same, excepting there I had a machine gun, a Lewis gun, not the machine, a Lewis gun course.
Could you describe that course?
Well, you were just taught how to use the gun, how to take it to pieces, all the various parts that you could reassemble, and you were also informed how the gun worked and what kept it cool. It was an air-cooled gun, and the air just rushed through this outer cylinder around the barrel as you fired the shot, so the bullet leaving the muzzle drew the air through past the barrel, which kept it cool. And a very rapid rate of fire, and you're taught how to take a exchange the magazines, put one on, take the other off, and so on. What to do if there was a jam.
What did you have to do if there was a jam in the gun?
I can't tell you. I know we did it, but I can't remember just actually what we did, technically.
Was there any practice in such things as firing the gun at night?
No, not at night. No, but we fired it on a range.
Was it a difficult weapon to use?
No, very easy. Very easy. It would take one to pieces and reassemble it, keep it going.
How long did that course last for?
I think about 2 weeks. Also went there also while I was at Arsus, she went on a signalling course with field telegraphs and also flag signalling. But when I'd been on that about a fortnight, well, we got orders to go and draft to France, and that was the end of that.
So you didn't complete the course, in fact?
No. And I also went on a revolver and range finding course with a Barr and Stroud range finder, which was quite interesting. And we used to go out to the fields and into the country and range on certain objects, so exactly what range they were. And then which was interesting but easy.
What did you actually have to do to use this Barr and Stroud rangefinder?
Well, there were two handles underneath, and there was a wheel that you just turned until two objects converged.
Was it a sort of sight that you looked down?
As you see in a rangefinder in a camera today, very much like that, excepting that with the Barr and Stroud rangefinder was also telescopic, so it brought the object very close to you, and then you got the exact range of it. Also on this revolver course, we taught Smith & Wesson revolver. I got a marksman in that too. How to fire the revolver, load it, etc. And none of that business like you see on the movies. You draw it upwards like that and fire. So yes, I got a marksman in there. No, I had that course, but never used a rangefinder when I went to France. And never used a revolver either.
Did you volunteer for these courses, or were you assigned to them?
Consigned to them.
And what do you think the purpose of all that was? So to make you flexible at the front, or?
I suppose so, and I thought it was just seemed to be part of the routine. They picked out certain people, all the intelligent ones.
Is that a fact? Are you
well, they never seem to pick the gormless ones. Every has some pretty funny characters, you know. I don't really know why you were picked. You were never told. You were just told you will be on a machine gun course commencing next Monday. Report at the orderly room the night before, and so on.
One thing I didn't mention at the beginning is when you moved from Priestheath to Oswald Street, did you stay in the same unit?
No, we went to a different training reserve battalion, and that was under the King's Own Royal Lancashire. It had been in Priestheath and the Lancashire Fusiliers.
I see. So whilst you were at Oswestry, you were actually learned of your draft. Is that correct? Whilst you were at Oswestry, you learned that you were going to be drafted
to
France.
Yes.
How long have you been at Oswestry when you heard of that news?
Well, I say I went the autumn of 1917, and just heard at towards the end of March 1918 that we were going on draft. That was when there was a big push by the Germans, and they were trying to get the Channel ports, and Haig said, "We've got our backs to the wall," that famous saying, and they were just rushing all the troops they could out to France right away, and we left on the 2nd of April.
Did you have much advance notice that you were going to be taken out?
About a week. And sent on draft leave and recalled before it was over and told you were going out almost right away.
Could you say, how long were you sent on leave for?
Well, we just gave draft leave I can't think what day it was, but I'd only been at home 3 days and got a telegram from the unit to return at once, draft proceeding overseas Thursday.
What was the reaction of your family to the news that you were...
Well, it was just my mother and aunt in row. They were quite aghast. In fact, I concealed it a bit, you see. I didn't say I was going... I just said that the situation was so serious in France that they were calling all troops so as to be ready on hand, and they might just send them out, to the base in case they were needed. That's what I said, you see. I didn't say we're going to be shipped to France and probably be in the line within a fortnight.
I see, and you were called back 3 days early, you said?
Yes, I think I'd only been home about 3 days.
How did you receive the news that...
A military policeman came to the door. Said, "Are you H.H. Cooper, so-and-so?" And he said, "Well, you've got a telegram for you." And he read out this telegram: "Return to unit at once." And I went off about 6 o'clock next morning.
And when you returned to Oswestry, what was the atmosphere like in the camp with the news of the draft?
Well, a lot of them didn't return. They returned late, and I thought, "Well, why didn't I return late?" But no, they didn't seem to get into trouble. No, it was a sort of, well, perhaps a mock cheery atmosphere. Come on, this way to Germany, or go Berlin next week. What about Ruhleben prisoners of war camp? That's where we'll be chums next week. All that sort of banter, you see.
What was your own reaction to the news of going out to France?
Oh, a bit it was sort of worrying, yes, worrying. But as I said before, I said we think it was the inevitable had reached us, and we were just going. It didn't keep me awake at night or anything like that.
Would you say at that time that the men that you were going out to France with had a sort of spirit of unit identity and a feeling of being together as a group?
I don't think so particularly. Except when, everywhere we were addressed as fall in the draft come here, etc. I knew them all, but I don't recollect us having any particular pride that we were the first King's Own going out to France.
How many were in the draft?
About 30.
Could you just tell me a little bit about the relationship between yourself as a private and your contemporaries as a private, and also your relationship with senior officers?
Well, all the men or privates got on excellently together, and they're from all walks of life, top to bottom, I think. But my brother and I have often said, what a good lot they were, and there was no class distinction or thought of it at all. But the NCOs, even from a Lance Corporal, they were a part. I mean, a corporal wouldn't sit down and chat with you and have a cigarette or anything. They had to maintain the difference all the time. And it always had to be yes, sergeant, no, sergeant, yes, corporal. It was an order, usually. And as regards the officers, they were very remote. In fact, I don't think I was ever spoken to by any officer or sergeant major all the time I was at Oswestry or pre-chief, unless it was an order. They were just very remote altogether.
Did that change in France?
Not much, no. I only remember, when you were in the line, of an officer used to perhaps walk along the trench and come back, but he'd never sort of sit, have a chat, or even, excepting one officer, two officers I remember that were more or less human to the privates. But we didn't resent it. We didn't say, "Oh, that snobby sod," or anything like that. No, that was just what you accept. He was an officer, you were a private. And you've been brainwashed and trained that way ever since you joined. It was just accept, just the same as at school. You accept the headmaster. You don't expect him to come and pat you on the back or start telling you jokes. Well, it was the same between officers and privates and NCOs. Everybody knew their place, just where they were and how far they could go. And it wasn't resented by anybody.
Were you given special instructions about how to act towards officers and more senior
Well, at
members?
The beginning, yes, an officer was always there, but I think it just came to you in the way you saw the officer himself acted, and without thinking very much about it.
Were you actually told anything about the regiment's history to sort of try and sort of instill some sort of idea of regimental
We were about the Lancashire Fusiliers quite a lot.
This was when you were at Priest Heath?
Yes. But about the First King's Own, I don't think we ever told anything about the history of them. No.
As you left Oswestry Camp and embarked on your journey down to France, did you feel that you'd been well trained? Were you confident about your abilities as a fighting man now?
I don't think we gave it much thought, honestly. I don't think we gave it much thought.
Looking back, after your first experience in France, did you feel that your training had been adequate when you actually got to the trenches?
I felt it had been adequate, yes. But I think the main thing about the training was that it hardened you and made you healthy and strong and used to discipline and doing what you were told and having long hours and not grumbling and becoming used to it.
Okay, thanks. Right, on the day that you left Oswestry, could you describe your journey, what events happened between there and Folkestone?
Yes. Well, actually, we left Parkhall Camp. All the drafts were assembled, and we walked to Gabowen Station, which is just near the camp. Big troop train roared in. We all scrambled in, full of jokes and boyish, really. And it started about, we travelled all through the night, stopped at Birmingham. And at Birmingham, I remember... Some girls came on with tea, and we got that, and then everybody got out of the train with their mugs, and there were some milk cans on the platform. We opened all these milk cans, filled off cups full of milk, went back to the train, and as it left, we all threw our cups out. No, railway cups we got, all threw them onto the platform. The platform was all covered with snow of white broken cups.
Were you reprimanded at all for that?
No, not a word. No, I don't think anybody ever thought of it. And we got down to Folkestone, marched along the front and went to a boarding house, which was, of course, all the houses on the front were empty. And then we had breakfast of bread and bacon and tea. Then we saw these cross-channel boats all painted grey alongside the quay. Marched onto those. Nobody to wish us goodbye, no bands or anything yet. So, and then they moved off across the channel.
Were you given any special instructions whilst you're on board ship?
No, not at all. We just stood up on deck. The ship zigzagged across the channel, and people were counting. Just the lads are shouting, get hold of your life belt, we'll never get to France, and jokes like that.
Were you aware of any threat from submarines at that time?
Well, only because the boat was zigzagging, using avoiding action, you see.
And you arrived at Boulogne. What happened there?
Then we just disembarked and went to... it was called Seary Billet. It was an old French factory, I think. And then we were issued with bread. I remember we had bread, and we were surprised that the bread was gleaming white, because we got used to the brown bread, and it was really white. And we were only there about an hour, and then we went to Boulogne Station, got into this train, a series of cattle trucks, which had, I always remember they used to have had 40 men and 12 horses, as Carandon, Dues, the Chevaux.
Were there any horses with you?
Oh, no, no, just about 20 men to a truck. There were covered trucks, you know. And we just ground our way on till we... well, afternoon, we reached a station called Simon Court.
What was the accommodation on those trucks like? Were you able to sit down?
Sit on the floor. It was just a bare, empty, covered truck. In fact, there's a picture of them in the...
Yes. So there were no sort of toilet arrangements or...
Oh, facilities. Heavens no. Yeah. The train stopped, someone sort of jumped out and went behind a hedge, you see. Oh, no, no toilet arrangements. No heating, of course.
By the time that you reached Simon Court, how long had your journey taken?
I can't... I should think a couple of hours, perhaps. I honestly can't remember.
No, I meant from Park Hall Camp at Oswestry Street.
Oh, from Park Hall Camp. It was Park Hall Camp. We left at about 6 o'clock one night, and we were still on our way on the cattle trucks train at 2 o'clock in the afternoon the following day.
Had you any opportunity to sleep on these journeys?
No, I mean, I think perhaps one or two dozed off, but just lay on the floor. No, I think we were rather interested in passing through the country. And soon after we left Boulogne, we saw on a slope, a huge military cemetery, a forest of white crosses. And of course, that put us down in the dumps a bit, I think, when we saw that.
Did you see any evidence of war on this journey, apart from the military cemetery?
Oh, no, they never got near Boulogne, not within miles. It wasn't till we got near Simon Court that we saw some tanks undercover and some also very new built trenches with barbed wire in case there was a big advance to that area. We did see those sort of reminders of war. Also I boarded up four of this point gas masks will be carried.
At Simon Court, what happened?
We all got off the train. We took a march to a camp, a smallish camp, just all Nissen. You know what a Nissen hut is? All Nissen huts. And it was a soup of mud, this camp. About this deep.
What, 2 inches?
In some parts, yes. And then we... No, the one in charge of our draft reported, and I suppose a sergeant major came. One thing I thought was rather considerate, which we didn't expect, and the 30 of us was assembled. They said, "Well, are there any of you pals that want to remain together because you're going to be distributed in various companies?" And Pottle's my friend. I said, "Yes, we'd let another stay there," and they kept us together. I was assigned to B Company in the 1st King's Home. And then we went in one of these Nissen huts, and the several troops had just come out of the line at Arras. So they were all caked with mud and dirty, and one of them, I remember, had a German helmet perched on his head. And
were you able to talk to those troops?
Oh, yes, yes.
Did they give you any information about the front line that you hadn't been aware of?
Not very much, no.
What were their spirits like?
Oh, very good. Very good.
You mentioned that the troops were covered in mud and so on. Did they clean up at all?
Oh, that was one of the first things they had to do. The next one, they had to clean their putties, their boots, even buttons and everything. And they had a parade soon after coming out, and it was an inspection parade, almost as if we'd been at Oswestry Camp.
Did that surprise you?
It did, yes. It was done, of course, to keep up the morale. You can't have a good morale with a dirty lot of troops. Yes, because everybody thought, oh, the, when there was ours, say, oh, we won't have all this spit and polish when we get out of it. We did. You never had any inspection of ours cleanliness in the line, but you did when you were once out of it.
Whilst you were at Simon Corps, did you have to do any particular tasks?
Yes, we were all hauled out, not only our draft, but lots in that camp, to go down to Brumettes, where it was a railhead, where they were loading lots of trucks full of planks of wood. And we, German planes came over and the searchlights started, and then all the AK-AK guns started firing, and we saw, that was the first sort of signs of war, really, for us, seeing these bursting shells up in the searchlights, etc. And they did drop bombs rather distant, not on the actual railhead, but we were allowed to go under the big among the stacks of planks of wood in case they were there, to afford protection to us in case any bombs did come. But soon that scare was soon over, and then we finished unloading the planks and back to Simon Court camp.
What was your reaction to this air raid?
Well, I think interest more than fear. And when I hadn't we heard shells coming into Bermetz, and I hadn't even thought about what sort of noise a shell made, and made this long screaming noise and the explosion. So that was quite, well, it was interesting too, besides being rather scary.
Whilst you were at Simon Corps, were you assigned to any particular unit within the King's Own?
A different company, yes. I was assigned to B Company with Pottles. Corporal Tedder was the corporal there in charge, and I remained in B Company till the end of the war.
And that was...
Well, nearly, towards the end of the war.
That was a rifle unit, was it?
Yes.
Okay. Following your stay at Simon Corps, indeed, how long did that stay last for?
Just a few days, and then we had to parade. We were moving up, and we had quite a march down to one of those long French roads with trees on each side, and there were great lines of motor trucks. Half a mile of them we could see in. We were about 20 men loaded into each one, and they rode off, and we began our long journey from just behind ours right up to the La Bassée front. And we must have moved off in before midday, and we didn't get to the La Bassée area till about 5 o'clock in the evening.
Did you actually know you were going to the La Bassée front line?
No, we didn't know where we were going. Excepting, I think one of the drivers told us, oh yes, I think you're going near the La Bassée Canal.
Did that mean anything to you when he said it?
Not a thing, no. But we did, there were sort of rumours and talk about that there'd been a breakthrough up there, and that we were, our whole division was being, not only the King's Own, but the 4th Division was being rushed up there to fill up the break in the line.
So you realised that you would be in action?
Yes, pretty soon.
How did you feel about that?
Well, when we got that very night, when we got to Lillers, that's a small town, probably about 4 or 5 miles from the La Bassée Canal, and there were all refugees on the road with hand carts and horses and all their goods and perambulators, you know, all getting away from the German advance, you see. And they gave us a great welcome and handed us out bread and biscuits and cheered and so on. So we were rather, of course, with our young minds, we thought it marvellous to have this sort of hero's welcome, although we'd done nothing at all. And we went just through Lillers, and we just went into the gardens of a house.